In the Moment on SDPB is supported by the South Dakota Humanities Council, presenting the South Dakota Festival of Books, September 20th through 22nd in Brookings.
South Dakota is no stranger to financial scandal. What are we going to do about it? From SDPB, today is Wednesday, August 21st. This is In the Moment. Coming up this hour, the South Dakota State Auditor offers a history lesson that goes back to statehood when the state treasurer made off with funds and the governor was left holding the empty bag. The legacy has ramifications for financial oversight measures today. Rich Satgast is with us. Then the Dakota Political Junkies join us for a look at vulnerability and oversight of taxpayer dollars. What might we see in an upcoming legislative session to address the gaps? Plus, a new book explores the brutalities of the KKK in South Dakota. We'll talk with the author. We're broadcasting live today from SDPB's Kirby Family Studio in Sioux Falls. I'm Lori Walsh. You're in the Moment. News is first. You're listening to In the Moment on SDPB. I'm Lori Walsh. South Dakota is no stranger to financial scandal and misdeeds using taxpayer money and state resources. SDPB has reported on two recent cases of former state employees taking advantage of the system. One former Department of Social Services employee allegedly stole $1.8 million. That case is working its way through the court system. Another former state employee has been accused of defrauding banks by creating fake vehicle titles to get loans, using her role within the Division of Motor Vehicles to commit the alleged crimes. Since that employee has now passed away, South Dakota's Attorney General says no charges are pending. When scandals break, people want to know, how did this happen? How do we keep this from happening again? And maybe even, who is to blame? So in order to find answers, we all need to get a lot smarter about how state finances work. And that is complex and multi-layered. Rich Satgast is South Dakota State Auditor. He's an elected official, and it's important to understand here that his office does not have oversight of how state departments create internal controls or whether or not employees are following those controls. We asked him to join us in the studio to talk about oversight of state money, and this conversation is going to include a big old history lesson going back to statehood and a warning about how Satgast believes taxpayer dollars are vulnerable to attack and misuse and what he would do about it.
There's a lot of tentacles at work in state government. All expenditures and all receipts begin at the agency level. And so each agency, 20-some plus agencies, all have their own finance officers. They'll receipt money in if they are a revenue source for funds, such as game, fish, and parks. Even the Secretary of State's office has revenue that comes in. Mm-hmm. And then there's the finance officers do all of the calculating for expenditures as well. And so if there's travel receipts or somebody, the state employee has done travel, then those finance officers will compile all the documentation and then send it on to the auditor's office. We like to say that there's really a three-legged stool in state government. Okay. It's the auditor, the treasurer, and Bureau of Finance and Management. And we're all very close in proximity on second floor in the Capitol building. We work very closely together on reconciliation of both expenditures and receipts, and we work very closely together on a daily basis. There's a lot of other tentacles out there, and I can get into those a little bit later if you'd like to.
Let's do a little history here in a moment, okay. But first, you know, people are paying attention to this for a reason, so I think it's important to get to this question, even if it's not a one-word answer, which is, who does the buck stop with? When we look at misdeeds by state employees who have misused the money or misused mm-hmm. their resources or their authority with public money, who does the buck stop with?
Certainly. I think the buck stops in a lot of different areas. There's not just one entity that oversees the expenditures of state government. We have it all divided up for the checks and balances purpose of it. So for my office, we do a 100% pre-audit of all expenditures of state government. But those are within certain guidelines. We only have certain statutory allowances that we can do as far as delving into how state agencies are spending their money. There is another auditor in state government called the Auditor General. That person is hired by the legislature. I believe it's for possibly 8-year term that they get hired for, but there is no term limit on them being hired. They're hired by the executive board of the legislature and then confirmed by the entire legislature to serve out that term. They actually have the statutory authority to subpoena documents. They have full authority to go into any state agency, any county government, and any city government. The Auditor General then has the authority to go in and ensure that there's proper checks and balances within each agency and make sure that there's proper oversight and that they are following those.
You're an elected official.
I am an elected official.
All right. So then one of my questions is, when there's an investigation like the ones that we have seen, one of these is with a deceased person, so the Attorney General's office says there's not going to be any charges filed. How do you want to address that case is what
Certainly,
I'm asking.
Certainly, and I'm assuming that's the one with the Division of Motor Vehicles.
Yes.
Is that my office has absolutely nothing to do with that investigation because it was not public funds that this person was stealing, as far as my knowledge is. And so, you know, I really don't have a whole lot to comment on it. It was the defrauding of banks and using state resources in order to defraud banks.
To create a fake title.
Absolutely.
Who's checking to see that the titles are, is that the department head then, at the Department of Motor Vehicles?
Right.
I'm sorry, the Division.
Division of Motor Vehicles.
Motor Vehicles, yeah.
Yes. Internally, they should have different checks and balances that they require. I don't have any oversight on that other than I'm on the Board of Internal Controls.
Okay.
And so there is a couple of employees who work directly for the Board of Internal Controls, and they work with each state agency to get them onboarded to put together these internal controls. Now, in my office, when I worked on the onboarding to get my office up to speed with internal controls, it was extremely helpful, I have to say that, because we had some areas that, you know, especially when you transition from one elected official to another elected official, you have employees transition. Certain checks and balances can get lost, but because of these written down internal controls, we now, on a regular basis, quarterly, check to make sure that those internal controls are being followed.
Mm-hmm.
So that would be with that Board of Internal Controls to ensure that those are being followed, as well as, I would assume, legislative audit, because they are the ones that have to also make sure that each agency is following their own regulations that they have set down for internal controls. And I mean, there's a number of things that you have to have set up for these type of controls. Number one is separation of duties is a big part of it. That's always been a huge one that we've dealt with in the auditor's office, is ensuring that we have separation of duties, that one person that is looking over the vouchers is not the same person that releases the voucher for payment. The other thing is ensuring that proper authorizations are intact, and every agency should have a checklist on how those authorizations are being worked. Another one is having a setup so that you can anticipate what type of payment should be making and what the dollar amount should be.
Sure.
And then taking a look at and what the actual payments are. If you're expecting at one point that, yeah, we're going to be spending, you know, $250,000 in this category, and you're spending $300,000+, there's a miss there. And so you need to be checking to see, why are these numbers not matching up, what our anticipated expenses are and what actual expenses are.
Yeah. So through your role on the Board of Internal Controls, the questions you're asking are the right systems in place, and then were those systems followed?
Correct.
Do you know in this case if the right systems were in place or if they were not followed?
I do not at this point in time. Okay. We'll have a meeting coming up here in another month.
Okay.
Where we'll probably get briefed on that as well.
Okay. Yeah. And I think that's why you as an elected official have, you know, when you try to get department heads and people in, they can't necessarily come. You come because the voters put you there and you can explain things, even though they might not necessarily be something
Absolutely.
You had direct oversight. So I appreciate
Absolutely.
I appreciate you wading into it. But the meeting of the Board of Internal Controls will give you the information that you need to ask some of those questions.
Absolutely.
And hold people accountable.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
And that's one of the other things. So I met with Treasurer Hader.
Mm-hmm.
Last week, we had a meeting, and because we're trying to figure out, you know, other things that we can put in place for oversight. And that's why I would like to get into the historical part a little bit when we do get into it.
Okay. Let's do that now. Yeah.
Okay. Mm-hmm. So, you know, dating all the way back to the beginning of statehood is where we will probably begin, and I'll jump decades forward as we move into this. But taking a look at the first treasurer of the state of South Dakota, W.W. Taylor was his name. Mm-hmm. He was a banker out of Redfield that had moved to South Dakota from another state and got elected state treasurer, became good friends with Governor Millett, and was a very well-trusted investor. Well, there were some bad investments that he had made and lost several hundred thousand dollars over the course of the 4 years that he was the state treasurer. And when the time came for him to turn the funds back over, and Governor Millett had just praised him in front of the legislature for his service and that, you know, he was stepping down, after Millett gave his praising remarks, somebody whispered to him, the treasurer never showed up to turn the funds over. He had actually taken off with $367,000 of state money. Hmm. He had taken off with all the money. He had gotten some bad advice. He had told Governor Millett that, yeah, I had losses. I'd invested in some mining company in Venezuela and Latin America, and I'd invested in wheat futures and some other things, and we just lost a lot of money. Governor Millett was one of the bondsmen for him and said, well, we'll work to make this whole. Treasurer Taylor decided he was going to visit with a law firm out of Chicago, and they said, you know what, we can probably negotiate this down with the legislature and what you actually owe, so we suggest you take all the money, and then we'll negotiate you giving it back. Well, that didn't work out so well. The legislature of South Dakota put a $2,000 bounty on Taylor's head, and he went gallivanting around Latin America. When he came back, he had spent another $200,000 of the state's money.
Wow.
He was later convicted and served 18 months in the state penitentiary until it was found out that there was a glitch in the law and he was released and he left the state. Governor Millett, who had really, you know, worked to get South Dakota into statehood, this really ruined him because the state took his house as collateral for him to help pay back the funds. The state later gave this house back to his widow after Millett had died. To bring this all the way full story, the legislature put some really strict restrictions on what the treasurer could invest in. Sure. And that's even done at the county level. And so the treasurer couldn't just pick and choose what they wanted to invest in. It had to be certain types of investments that the treasurer could invest in. And that lasted all the way up until about the 1960s, till the legislature started looking at, is South Dakota missing out on how we're investing our funds? Yeah. Wouldn't it be better if we were able to invest in the stock market and maybe some riskier investments and reap the benefits of that? The problem is that at the time, term limits were in place for all the constitutional offices. It was two-year terms that they could serve. So you'd have a treasurer in there for 4 years, and if they were doing the investing, then all of a sudden you turn it over to somebody new and they've got a different idea of how they want to do it. There wouldn't be any continuity in how the investments would flow. And so the legislature put in place a professional investor that they would hire. Most states don't hire a professional investor. They hire firms who charge exorbitant amounts of money to do the investing on behalf of these other states. But South Dakota started this experiment back in 1971 where they put a guy in by the name of Steve Meyer. And he's really the founder of the State Investment Office in South Dakota. He was given a small office down in the basement of the Capitol, and he was given an assistant, and they started him out with small amounts of money. As time went on, he proved himself and grew the State Investment Office. Today, I have to say that he turned the reins over to Matt Clark. Matt Clark is by far one of the best leaders I've seen in the investment world. South Dakota has everything to be proud of their investment office, and they're part of this checks and balances as well, because we in Pierre all rely on them for how our finances are handled in South Dakota. And so that investment office is renowned worldwide for how well they do in the investment world, and so we're very proud to have that. But that's how that came about, and it removed the investing away from this elected official of the state treasurer.
Okay.
So that's where we got there. Now, still looking at the 1970s, if you take a look at what had started occurring during World War II when the federal government started pumping a little bit more money into the states. And then you get into the 1960s and you have LBJ, who was working with the Great Society and was pumping more money into social programs that were coming back to the states. There was an influx of federal dollars that were coming in. It was really starting to overwhelm what the state auditor's office could do. Mm-hmm. At the time, Alice Kundert was the state auditor. And this was also as computerization started coming about. Well, Alice was a little bit on the older side. Computers were pretty new, and she wasn't quite comfortable with it. She was used to just handling ledgers on a piece of paper for handling the auditing portion of it. She actually signed all of the checks herself, where we have auto pens that do it now, or we do wire transfers and the such. But she would actually do those. So she allowed the governor's office and the Bureau of Finance and Management to take over the accounting system. This really limited the auditor's ability to really see what is going on. In the 1990s, Vern Larson commissioned a CPA firm to come in and audit how we were reviewing payments. And that firm came up with a number of suggestions that one of them was the accounting system should be under the office of the state auditor. And Vern diligently fought on that behalf and what that document had stated. You have to understand these constitutional offices do not have a veto and they don't have a vote. And so when our voices get heard in the legislature, they're not always heard so well because we don't have the ability to do compromises the way that a governor's office may or a legislator may be able to do. Unfortunately, Vern wasn't able to get very far with that. I took over in 2003 and Vern handed that document to me. And in 2003, I took up the battle fight on that. I had just come from being the executive director for Association of Counties at the time. And I had a lot of strong legislators as supporters of mine, and so we worked on that behalf. Got into some tussles with Second Floor over some of the things that I was trying to do. One of the things that I was championing was to automate and computerize the state's consultant contract program. And so I was requesting $35,000 to put together this program. I had upset the Second Floor so badly that they were not going to allow that $35,000 to get transferred to my office. We had $2.5 billion budget at the time. It was held up because the head of appropriations, Jerry Apa, and a couple of the other appropriations members, Bill Napoli and a few others, stood by my side and said, we're not passing this budget until you approve the $35,000. The governor's office said, we're not approving the $35,000. It was the last thing to get finalized in that budget year, and I ended up with the $35,000. Here we are 20 years later, still have that same computer system, and it's cobbled together because there's even printers don't speak to the software that we had built 20 years ago on that. So it's been a long fight in the auditor's office on what we can and can't do. That'll be a fight that we'll continue on with.
What do you think needs to happen next? What do you want?
Right. Well, and we've got some great opportunities coming forward, and it's not always people, but you do have to have eyes on the documents, and that's what Treasurer Hayter and I were talking about extensively is that, you know, while we're moving forward with automation, the legislature passed a $70 million accounting bill a year or so ago. That was a year ago. And this $70 million is to update our 40-year-old accounting system that we currently have. It's over 40 years, different agencies have put in different programs. They don't all speak together very well. And so this is a much-needed influx of money in order to do that. Now, I know a number of legislators and a number of people say, well, automation's not always, you know, what it's cracked up to be. I can say what it will do is it will free up what my office has to meticulously do currently, which it'll take out the human error aspect of it, because we have three requirements when we are auditing documents that come through the office. First of all, they need to be true. And what does that mean? Well, We have to have all the proper documentation that, you know, say it's a state employee's travel documents. Mm-hmm. We have to have all the receipts. If they're attending a conference, we have to have their conference agenda, because we need to make sure that, number one, if they're getting fed, they're not getting reimbursed on per diem. We are one of the only states that audits to this degree. Most states put a cap on it of $5,000 to $10,000. Anything below $5,000 to $10,000, they don't take a look at, because mm-hmm. most states figure that's not enough money to bother with. In South Dakota, we look at $5. We look at any reimbursement. We recalculate. We make sure that all the documentation is there and that somebody's not getting overpaid. That same with invoices for construction projects. We do the same thing. We go through those invoices, and we'll send back. We've sent back anywhere between 1,500 and 5,000 documents a year for more information or proper calculation or reauthorization of it. The next is, okay, so there's the true portion of it. The correct portion is that we recalculate all those numbers. So if somebody's traveling from Pierre to Sioux Falls, we recalculate their mileage and recalculate the mileage reimbursement to make sure it's correct. If we have an automated system that will do that, where we don't have to recheck that, we can just go in and randomly check those to make sure that the system hasn't been tweaked. The last part is authorized, and this is where it comes down to the state agencies, because in statute, cabinet secretaries are authorized to put people in place that oversee making sure, and they're called the finance officers, and making sure that the documents that are coming into my office are correct. And so we have to make sure that all the proper authorizations are on there.
Yeah. So you have to figure out that balance point for your regulatory framework
right.
as well. How much is too much?
Right.
You know, that we can't sustain, you know, the number of auditors it might take, for example. So what I'm hearing you say is that we actually have more of a regulatory framework than maybe some other states do, but the systems that those people are using need to be updated to make all this more efficient and effective?
Absolutely. And also, you know, changing the way that we are looking at some of these things. And that's what I've been visiting with Treasurer Hader about, is that, you know, there are authorizations at the local state agency level. Our offices as elected officials, maybe we need to be involved in that authorization process. They've already got the Board of Internal Controls that have set these internal controls at state agencies mm-hmm. for state agencies to follow. We probably need to be looking at those a little bit closer, because as the Board of Internal Controls, we don't actually see what internal controls each agency has. And part of that is by design, because if those become public, then bad actors outside the system can then use those to figure out how to
find the vulnerabilities.
Right. You know, and so that's, I hate to put it this way, but I'll just say that We'll put it like mice in a maze. I'm not saying state employees are mice by any means. I'm just saying bad actors are the mice. Mm-hmm. We need to keep changing the maze so they can't so easily find the cheese.
Mm. The Board of Internal Controls does not see, so the DSS fraud, which is alleged and still being investigated, so there's not a mm-hmm. whole lot we can say about that until that, you know.
Correct.
However, you would not know ahead of time what kind of internal controls DSS had for authorizing expenditures. You would find out on the board after something had happened, and then you would be asking those questions about what internal controls were they followed.
Right. They do a self-assessment. Each agency does a self-assessment. We receive an email that then prompts us to go in and checkmark whether or not these internal controls have been followed or not. And so each agency is doing a self-assessment. I'm saying we need to probably not only have that self-assessment, but the state auditor and the state treasurer. In my respect, the state auditor needs to be looking at what internal controls do you have for authorizing payments. The state treasurer would probably be looking at what internal controls are you having to make sure that checks are getting sent to the treasurer's office so we can get that money put into the investment council. Mm.
And we don't have that now because of the history that you laid out.
Correct.
For us there.
Correct.
Full circle.
Yes.
Okay. What else am I missing that I should be asking you? Why have you here?
I just think that, you know, with the legislature, we really need to be working with the legislature on this. And yeah. I'm not pointing fingers anywhere. You go back to 2010, South Dakota was in financial hardship and a difficult time where 10% cuts were the way that we were going to be going. And a lot of agencies, I think, took hits. 2020 was another area that really hit agencies hard. In peer, it's very difficult to find people to fill a lot of these slots. So there's people pulling double duty. Mm-hmm. And so while you may have internal controls in place, you don't have the people to fully fill those positions. So you have people doing multiple positions that they shouldn't be doing. Mm-hmm. I don't know how you get around that when you have an employee shortage such as we do. My office, I've hired 3 people from out of state, and I only have 16 people in my office.
You were treasurer?
Yes.
You were auditor, treasurer, and then auditor again. So
yes.
When you talk about 2010 and 2020, were you were in office during both of those times. So you witnessed some of this firsthand, and it's been a slow-motion car crash?
It has been a slow-motion car crash, and that's, you know, I think a number of our areas that are checks and balances are having a very difficult time, especially in the oversight portion of it. It's difficult to get those people into peer. In Sioux Falls, Department of Revenue has part of their agency here in Sioux Falls, simply for the fact that you don't have enough people in peer to fill those revenue positions. And so when you're talking about Division of Motor Vehicles and everything, I think there's a big part of it that is a staffing issue.
Yeah. So we are vulnerable to more loss.
Oh, yes, absolutely.
There is a real risk because of staffing, because of outdated systems, because of the complexity of it, which is
right.
Very natural. So in some ways, we're doing better than a lot of states. In other ways, you could say, hold on for the ride, because there could be more bad actors in state government who are, or outside of state government, who are infiltrating. It's really important. That's what I'm getting from this.
It is.
Am I thinking about this the right way?
You are thinking about it the right way. And I do want to...
Because it's complicated.
It is very complicated.
And my little brain is trying to get around all of it.
And I want to put a plug in. I want to put a plug in for our outside partner, the bank that we contracted, the state treasurer contracts to handle all of our funds. They're a big part of this oversight and checks and balances, because they fend off bad actors from the outside state government on a regular basis. And so we're greatly appreciative of the work that the bank that we contract with, that the work they do.
Yeah. That is South Dakota Auditor Rich Satgast. You're listening to In the Moment on SDPB. I'm Lori Walsh. All right, we just heard South Dakota State Auditor Rich Satgast. Now we are going to welcome the voices of our Dakota Political Junkies for the day with some analysis of this. John Hunter is Publisher Emeritus of the Madison Daily Leader, member of the South Dakota Newspaper Hall of Fame, and Michael Card is a political scientist and Professor Emeritus at the University of South Dakota. Dr. Card, welcome. Thank you so much for being here.
Thanks for inviting me.
John Hunter, welcome back.
Thanks, Lori.
All right. What stands out to you about what you just heard Auditor Rich Satgast say in that interview? There's a lot there, but let's begin, John.
I appreciated Rich's comments, and he I think publicly admitted there are weaknesses in the system, and that some of them maybe are in other offices, some may belong in his, and that there needs to be pretty serious reform. And I totally agree with him. I appreciated his honesty. I was hoping, as I was anticipating, that he wouldn't say, nope, there's not a problem, this is a one-time thing. He didn't do that, and I appreciate his candor.
I'm going to get to something that you wrote in the Madison Daily Leader here in a minute with your editorial with a bigger picture. But first, Mike Card, what stood out to you from that interview as well?
Well, it's easy to point fingers at somebody else, and I heard a little bit of that in Mr. Satgast's discussion. The entity that he didn't mention much is the Department of Legislative Audit, who has responsibility for financial and compliance audits for both the state agencies and for cities and counties and other taxing units. But the other part they're supposed to do is set up internal controls and audit for internal controls. So that form of program evaluation is apparently either not taking place, which is part of the culture of the organization, because it's the head of the agency who's responsible for setting up the culture that we set up internal controls, we monitor whether they're being followed, and the shortage of staff contributes against that or takes away from the ability to do that. But that still has to be done at least every year, and everyone needs to be reminded who's handling money, who's handling authorizations, whether it's, you know, in the university system handing out degrees, whether it's in the Department of Revenue giving titles and licenses. And, you know, this could affect every state agency. But there is much to be done. And not the least of which is the auditor doesn't have control over the accounting system, which I would think is a major problem, because can Bureau of Finance and Management cut a check without the auditor knowing? Treasurer would eventually figure it out, right? Because they have to reconcile the account.
Deep breath. And John, I keep coming back to, you know, who does the buck stop with? Who do voters hold accountable for this? If every single one of these people can say, rightfully so, that the buck stops with a lot of people, there are a lot of tentacles to state government. There are a lot of tentacles to oversight. We have other requests out for interviews to see if people will come and talk to us, including the Auditor General, what's the title exactly? Auditor General?
It's the Auditor General, Department of Legislative Audit.
Yes, so we have a request in this morning that we sent in for a follow-up interview with them as well. But, John, first of all, should the buck stop with one person? Do we need someone who is going to step out and say, I am going to root this out and solve this problem, or is it just a whole bunch of people getting together and trying to figure out what's going on? Because that doesn't seem very satisfying to a lot of people who want to pin something to the wall.
Right.
Or someone to the wall, as the case may be.
Yeah. I'm usually the one who mixes the metaphors, Laurie. So now that you've done it, I feel a lot better. So it is difficult to pin past acts on one person, I will say that. Yeah. And without satisfying those who really want a person to point the blame to, I think it is hard. But the solution, I think, is very much a person thing. There needs to be someone who takes a strong leadership position, preferably the governor, but there are other opportunities to do this. Said, look, this is a real problem in South Dakota. This is a big problem that needs to be fixed. I'm going to put my career on the line for this. I'm going to call everyone I know. I'm going to ask every lobbyist to get involved in this. I'm going to drive town to town and talk to legislators and say, it is my mission to fix this, and it can be done. It'd be great if the governor would do that. The governor sets the tone, at least intentionally or unintentionally, for all of state government, for all the 10,000 plus, I don't know, 12,000, however employees there are. The governor sets the tone. So if the governor of any time in the last 13 years when the Lana Carroll thing happened, that the governor said, I'm gonna make sure this, we're gonna have a moral, ethical, honest state government. The role of state employees is to serve the public. It is not for personal gain. And I'm going to make sure all my cabinet secretaries know that, and I'm going to make sure their department heads know that, and I'm going to preach that at every Lincoln Day dinner, that I talk to. And you can set the tone for that. Now, that's that one-person responsibility you're talking about. Then it really does have to spread out, that you have to have people willing to write policies and procedures that will satisfy the kinds of internal controls that Mr. Satgast was talking about. Then you have to have department heads who say, yes, we're going to follow these things. Remember we set them up in that meeting last summer? We're going to follow those. And they said, and you know what? As department heads, we want to welcome the auditors to our department. They're not going to be an annoyance or something that we're looking forward to or that we shun personally. We say, look, come on in. You can help boost the morale of this state department by doing a great job, by finding those very few bad actors, right? The majority of state employees are, I would guess, very hardworking and honest. And I would think they would want those rooted out. It's great for morale to find and clear those out. It's not great to, right now where they're trickling out and state employees think, where else is this occurring?
Right.
So I'm getting a little bit away from your question, Laurie, but that one person thing, I think it's hard to put a blame on that, but one person needs to take a leadership role and spread that mantra through all of state government.
What else needs to happen?
Well, I still think that the accounting system shouldn't be under the control of the Bureau of Finance and Management. It should be under those who are looking at the expenditures to see if they're according to appropriations by the legislature, and that those those expenditures are made according to what the legislature authorizes. That's the state auditor's job.
Yeah.
But it also falls upon the an auditor general in the Department of Legislative Audit to reinforce and to develop those internal controls. So, right, I mean, we've all been in organizations or groups where, well, you choose. Well, let's choose together. And if everyone's involved, then no one's really in charge, and bad things can happen. And I feel for state employees. During my time in state government, I did not run across anyone who was in any way, shape, or form out for themselves. And I think many people are going to be blamed just by association of being a state employee.
Right.
And that's unfair, but it's what it is.
Yeah.
That's what is. And it's patently unfair because people didn't root those out. So it was a preventable unfairness.
Right.
And this feeds into the we don't have enough staff.
Right.
Nobody wants to work in peer. It's very hard to find somebody to come take a job in peer. I hear that again and again. What's wrong with peer? Peer's a great community. What is happening in peer that people don't want to work there? Mike, do you have? I mean, you have to see the same thing with Vermilion. People are everybody wants to come to Sioux Falls.
Right. Well, it's a smaller community, and there aren't the amenities. And one thing we've learned from other states in terms of economic development is the amount of amenities that are associated with either geographic features or larger retail outlets, that's where people flock to. And peer, if you're into hunting and fishing, that's a great place to be. If you want to be in a university town, Vermilion's a great place to be, as is Brookings and all of our great universities in South Dakota. Those are amenities people go for,
right,
but they don't attract everybody.
And we love small town living. Many of us do. A lot of people in Sioux Falls grew up in small town, and they go home the second that they can to these small towns across the state. Is it an economic development? Now we're getting on the a different highway here, but. Again, it's about more than just saying, come move to South Dakota for our freedom. It's about giving people communities and amenities that sustain them and jobs that pay well and have good benefits to them for people to take these jobs.
And finding someone who's interested in public service as opposed to self-enrichment. But there are people out there that want to do that.
Say that again. as a public radio journalist, I want you to say that again.
Well, I think the issue that we're dealing with is there is a staffing problem, and part of the staffing problem is legitimately to implement broad-based internal controls is going to take more people. You could always make it so that there is no fraud if you're willing to spend the money to make sure there's no fraud. One way to do that is to keep people from spending money. But then you have your mission, and that's why I use the term program evaluation, because it's all the way from who are we supposed to be serving, what is the outcome that we're looking for, but along the way is a policies and procedures audit that takes place as the middle step once you've identified what are we trying to do, what does success look like. Then we start looking, do we have policies and procedures in place? Are we reaching the right people? Are we producing the outcomes? Mm. And every bit of a problem like this is probably like most bad reviews. It's going to get repeated 10 times more than a positive compliment would.
Right.
We
got 2 minutes left, John.
Fair enough. There is a state-of-the-art methodology to doing this well, and we can learn from others. Whether it's in private industry or other state governments or whatever there is. And there could some involve technology that wouldn't require as many people, but then you need to obviously audit that to make sure that the software doesn't get manipulated and so forth. And so Rich Sadgast, I think, effectively talked on that. But I want to emphasize that there is a right way of doing this, and it's available to us. And if someone takes a leadership position, it can be done. We can be the shining star among states and said that is the way to run state government to prevent fraud. That is available to us if we want it.
Yeah, we can't throw up our hands and just say, "Oh, this is going to happen." You know,
Yeah, concession is the worst thing, or apathy is
EB5,
the worst.
EB5, Gear Up, DSS scandal, Division of Motor Vehicles, misuse of funds. Yeah. And the 10 that we haven't discovered yet, because we're not really effectively checking, that we might find out next month for all I know. So we've got a lot of unanswered questions and a lot of uncomfortable people. And what I'm hearing you say is leadership, looking at those systems that, Auditor Sackgast said are perhaps arguably misplaced and need to be reevaluated.
Well done, teammates.
Yes. This is not the last time we're going to have this conversation. All right, we're going to wrap up with our Dakota Political Junkies. We've had John Hunter and Mike Card with us. We'll see you guys next time.
Great. Thank you.
Thanks.
You're listening to In the Moment on SDPB. I'm Lori Walsh. With me now is Arlie Fadness. He is the author of the nonfiction book, The Ku Klux Klan in South Dakota. And he is presenting on this book and what he learned in all his historical research in Sioux Falls next week. But the event at the library is full, so we wanted to invite him here into the Kirby Family Studio for a preview of that author talk. And I've already told Arlie we'll have to have you back for a much longer conversation about the book itself. But for all the people who can't get into the event, a little taste of this book. Tell me a little bit about when you first got the spark to write a book about the KKK in South Dakota. When was this history originally revealed to you?
All right. I was standing in Paraboom's restaurant in Webster, South Dakota. Yeah. Bob Bartles, an author, columnist for the Reporter and Farmer newspaper, had written two books about Day County and that whole area, drawing stories from his column that he'd written for years and years. And I bought the books, and all about Day County, mm-hmm. where I grew up. I loved the stories of jackrabbit hunting, coyotes, fishing, the birthplace of Tom Brokaw, where I was born, mm-hmm. same hospital.
Really?
All kinds of stories. Then all of a sudden, I came to chapter 51, and there it said, Ku Klux Klan came to Webster, my hometown. That's what got me going. I fell out of my chair, practically. And so I thought, I've got to find out more about this. And I learned that in 1925, I believe, there were 2,000 cars gathered at Webster, 5,000 people. So it was a big event, a conclave, convocation, they call them.
Okay.
And so that's got me going, and I raced out to the Black Hills and interviewed Professor Chuck Rambo.
Yeah.
He's done all the research.
And the artifacts that you find, even in your own family, you find artifacts that show a history of racism and something that we have to reckon with. Yes. Outside of the KKK itself, but just who our ancestors were sometimes, it's worth looking into. Tell me a little bit about some of the artifacts and objects that were particularly impactful as you did this research.
Well, the artifacts that Charles Rambo had are the ones that were most significant. And those were a banner of... the movie, Birth of the Nation, and he had the smallest Bible in the, and he had a symbol of KIA, which means a Klansman I am, which is a badge that they wore, and. Charles found in his closet some old rags that he thought he would use, but it was a Ku Klux Klan gown or, and plus a pointed hat. And so that's where the major artifacts. As far as my family, we had only one that nothing to do with the KKK, but racism, which we found a card that my uncle had written to my grandpa or vice versa.
Yeah, a postcard. There is a story. Tell me something about the murder of the Catholic priest in Lead.
Yes. His name was Father Arthur Belknap. He was a very popular priest in Lead, and he wanted to develop a youth center for the youth of the community, and because the influence of the miners wasn't that great at gold at the gold mine there. So he was going to start a youth center, and the Ku Klux Klan thought he was going to recruit young people to Catholicism. And, of course, the Ku Klux Klan, one of their main objects was Catholicism. Catholics, that was the one thing they were against. And so one night he went out to do a pastoral call in Lead, and he went to Poorman's Gulch in that area, and as it was the middle of the night, and he was with a companion, and the companion hit him in the head with a hammer and then shot him four times, and Father Belknap died on the spot, and it was a big thing then, and they couldn't find who did it, but they knew who did it, and but finally, there were some KKK people that were admitted that they were involved in his murder.
Hmm. How do you hope this book is used? How do you hope that people look at this part of our history with fresh eyes in 2024?
Great question. I was hoping you'd ask that. One of my purposes is that we will, since my topic is strengthening our democracy through the South Dakota Humanities, my purpose is that we will remember all of history. We will not exclude certain parts of our history. When I grew up, I knew nothing about hardly Native Americans. Nothing about the KKK, of course. I knew nothing about the Native Indian insane asylum at Canton. I knew nothing of these dark things in our history. And so my hope is that we will be okay with learning about the KKK in South Dakota, and that we will at the same time celebrate the good things and the bad and the ugly we'll learn from. Mm. Yeah.
And you're able to, as part of the Humanities Council speaker series, people can invite you to come to their town to talk about this and share more information, right?
Yes.
Okay.
Right.
We'll put a link up to the Humanities Council website so you can find Arlie Fadness, the scholar. But the book is called The Ku Klux Klan in South Dakota, by Arlie Fadness, and I thank you so much for coming here and giving us a preview. I think it is well worth diving into more of the stories in the future that you've pulled out in this book and having a longer conversation, but thanks for the preview today.
Yes, thank you, Laurie.
And that is our show for today. We hope that it served you. Tomorrow on the program, we are going to celebrate the somewhat end of summer by listening back to all so many songs of musicians that came and played for us here in the SCPB Sioux Falls studios. We'll bring those to you across the state on tomorrow's In the Moment. From all of us here at SDPB, I'm Lori Walsh. Thank you for listening.